Welcome to NASA Edge.
An inside and outside look at all things NASA.
We're live at Cape Canaveral Space Force Station in the often sunny Florida for the PACE launch. And Franklin, if this launch happens as expected, it will be very, very, very early tomorrow morning at around 1:30 a.m.
That's pretty early. And for those of you out there who don't know what PACE stands for, it is the Plankton Aerosol Cloud Ocean Ecosystem Mission, another Earth-observing satellite that NASA's putting into orbit that will benefit humanity.
That's very impressive, Franklin. I mean, you've already done better than I did in any of my biology and life sciences classes in high school. But I tell you what, we're going to have a lot of guests on the show that will help me and others understand this very important and fascinating mission for NASA.
And later on, we'll be joined by Mick Waltman from the Launch Services Program, who will give us an update on the Falcon 9, the PACE satellite, in preparation for launch.
And as we get ready for our first guest, I'm going to go do a little additional research by watching some phytoplankton videos. You're watching NASA Edge. We're looking live at Space Launch Complex 40, where the Falcon 9 with PACE on board is poised and ready for an early launch tomorrow morning. But joining us now here in Hangar AE is a very special guest, Nikki Fox, the Associate Administrator for the Science Mission Directorate. Nikki, thanks so much for being on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
It's always great to talk to you. And I'm curious if you could give me just a brief overview of the PACE mission and sort of how it fits into NASA's overall science mission.
Absolutely. So PACE itself is just an amazing mission. And for really the first time, we're going to be looking at all of the key elements of the climate research problem in one mission. So we're looking at the health of our oceans and the health of the air that we breathe and how that's one sort of connected system. And for me, that's kind of how all of the NASA missions fit together. It's one big connected system, looking from the very interior of our own star all the way out through, obviously at our own planet, the most important one, our planet, but then all the way out through our solar system and then into those, you know, amazing distant galaxies that we look at with Webb. And it's all connected. And so PACE is playing a very, very important part in that overall NASA mission.
Now, you mentioned that unique look through the entire aspect of our atmosphere and of course, the ocean. And it reminds me that continuous data record that we're always talking about at NASA, you know, how helpful that is. Why is it that continuous data record is so important for these science missions?
Well, really, because we want to understand not just what we're looking at today, but how it's changed over time. And the only way you can do that is to keep really accurate records. You know, the agency and other agencies around the world just a few weeks ago announced that 2023 was the hottest year on record. And we would only know that by having really good continuous data to be able to do that analysis. But the exciting thing about PACE is not just that it's continuing to give us the sort of the same data, it's actually giving it to us in a whole new way. And so, you know, I, as a child, you know, you like to color with your crayons and you really like those 8 crayons. Well, with PACE, we're getting that bumper box of crayons that everybody hoped for on Christmas Day with, you know, hundreds of different colors and different ways of looking at our ocean. And not only that, if you look at the ocean, we're talking about the fact that we're studying ocean color. If you look at the ocean, you don't see the color the way that we're talking about it. If you look at a prism, you just see a piece of glass. If you shine a light through the prism, you suddenly see the rainbow. We're essentially shining a light on the oceans and we're splitting it into all of the wavelengths, right from ultraviolet all the way up to the near infrared.
And I imagine those scientists are just chomping at the bit to get all those different wavelengths across that spectrum, because it's the data they get excited about.
Absolutely. Not just the data, but actually what it tells us. And so, you know, we've known that there are algae blooms and we've known there's phytoplankton in the oceans, but now with this unprecedented resolution, we can actually look at different species of phytoplankton, and that's exciting.
I know, it really is. Now, thanks so much, Nikki, for being on the show. I appreciate it because I'm laughing because I've been really studying this phytoplankton, and there are a lot of them. In fact, we want to take a look at a video done by the creative minds at Goddard Space Flight Center to learn more about this unique biological phenomenon.
One phytoplankton cannot do too much, but so many of them actually control everything we have, our food, our air that we breathe, and our climate. They're so powerful.
Phytoplankton, Mighty Titans, the Fido Fighters, are out to do battle on the seas. The evil Alexandrium is up to his old schemes.
My saxitoxins will poison your precious selfish.
You're no match for Dinophysis.
Dinophysis steals pigments from the Fido Fighters, but Protoperidinium lights up the battle with its bioluminescence. Who will reign marine supreme?
Go, Emiliana!
Only the Fido Fighters will decide the true fate of the seas. Each sold separately.
They're just insanely important. I mean, there's many things that are important, but these are insanely important. Plankton generally doesn't really mean like a taxonomic group of things. Like, you know, we think about mammals and then plants, and plankton are not that. Plankton are really defined by the way they live. Plankton means the wanderer in Greek. And these are just oceanic organisms that really just don't swim that fast that they can fight the ocean currents. It's a really non-traditional way of thinking about biology, in a sense. Plankton, we can define traditionally in zooplankton, so something that is kind of more animal-like, and phytoplankton, something that is more plant-like. All phytoplankton does process that we call photosynthesis. They take carbon dioxide and carbon in organic form, capture some of the sunlight, and then produce carbohydrates, or just simply said sugars, they now are carrying that sun energy and push it into the food system of the ocean. And while they're doing all that stuff, they also produce the oxygen. So opposite from us, we inhale oxygen, exhale carbon dioxide. So that's why they're really important. That's why we love them so much. And that's why they're like really crucial for the whole life on the earth. Phytoplankton itself, its diversity is gigantic. I think there's like 10,000 species, and each of them has a specific role. Why is there so much diversity in something that is so teeny tiny? It's fantasy, science fiction, and horror comes together. I mean, it's just so beautiful. But there's certain type of phytoplankton called coccolithophores, and specifically the most famous one is Emiliania huxleyi. But they take this inorganic carbon to make that something like a shell in which they live in. Their calcium carbonate, which they make, which is pretty much chalk, they make it in the shape of these hubcaps. And if you think about how teeny tiny they are, they're like, you know, I don't know, I can put probably like 30 or 40 or 50 of them in the width of my hair. When they bloom, once they die, not only they take that normal like sugar carbon that they produce, but they also take that calcium carbonate, that inorganic, that chalky material down to the bottom of the ocean. So they're really, really good for exporting carbon, removing it from this contact with the atmosphere, which is really important when it comes to the flow of carbon in the whole, you know, Earth ecosystem, but also control of the carbon in the atmosphere. So Alexandrium is a very specific type of phytoplankton. It's called a dinoflagellate. So it's kind of like maybe plant, maybe zooplankton, maybe animal, maybe can be both, no? But one thing that it does, it makes this very, 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 very powerful toxin. They're causing problems in Gulf of Maine. Alexandrium, you don't have to have a lot. Actually, really low numbers of Alexandrium can be present and produce really detrimental effect on humanity that feeds on this shellfish. So the changes of the color of the ocean due to the presence of this phytoplankton are just so miniature, no? We cannot see it with our eyes. But if we have sensitive instruments such as ocean color instrument on PACE, we're gonna be able to differentiate not only because it's sensitive to the intensity, but it's also sensitive to the colors. Having this hyperspectral view with really high sensitivity is going to allow me to differentiate much, much more of the phytoplankton, because each of them, or at least each group, has its own optical patterns. It's an optical fingerprint. We're hoping that PACE, due to its capabilities, is going to be able to really focus on specific species of interest, such as the harmful algal bloom species or species that are very beneficial for the growth of certain organisms. So the speciation is a function of the technical abilities that PACE has, but it's also, it's a function of our capabilities to understand the local ecosystem.
Joining us now is Antonio Menino, who's the Deputy Project Scientist for Oceans and obviously works on PACE. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I watched this video on phytoplankton, and when I recovered from the incredible amount of data, the first question I had is, this is fascinating, but how is PACE actually studying these incredible phytoplankton and actually using it for the PACE mission?
Yes, so the ocean color instrument on the PACE Observatory is measuring the light that's coming out of the ocean. And by separating the different signal, we can actually identify the different phytoplankton communities that are present in the ocean. As you saw in the previous video, each phytoplankton species or groups of algae have a different absorption spectrum, and that translates into different ocean color, which the ocean color instrument measures.
And so is it almost like a wellness check, looking at the ocean and seeing, you know, if that's healthy, then maybe our environment is healthy?
Yes, that's correct. Essentially, we're able to see how the Earth is changing, how the oceans are changing. Are the communities of phytoplankton that are present, are they changing over time? And are we shifting to smaller or more harmful algae?
Something like blooms can be at a particular time, but then you can look at that data over time and figure out how they work better.
Exactly. By understanding the mechanism that causes them to proliferate, we can make changes in policy and affect them, whether maybe it's runoff from excessive fertilizer running off of land into the coastal waters that promotes them. Those fertilizer can be reduced or can be modified in such a way that the runoff is diminished so you don't generate these harmful algal blooms.
Once PACE launches and is in space, is that what you'll be doing? Will you principally be studying all this data as it comes down for PACE?
That's part of what we'll be doing, yes. We'll also be actually going out to sea to verify the data products that are coming from the PACE mission. Even as we speak, we're preparing to go out to sea so that we can collect measurements both at sea, on the ground, and in the air to actually verify the data products that are coming. We know their uncertainties and can use them properly.
That's awesome. I always love the being able to corroborate and check the data. But I tell you, I have one more thing before you go, Antonio. Just bear with me. Be patient. These are the Phyto Fighters from a unique Goddard Space Flight Center collectibles toy collection. And I'm wondering, what do you think about these? Does this look accurate, like accurate representation of phytoplankton?
Well, the colors may not be, but the head portion of these Phyto Fighters represent individual phytoplankton cells. This one happens to be Emiliana huxleya that caused the White Cliffs of Dover. And that one is, I believe it's a dinoflagellate, a protoperidinium. So yes, but so the heads are accurate. The bodies are a bit anthropomorphized here.
Yeah, I'm intrigued by the good folks at Goddard who put this together, because to me they just look like great Christmas or holiday presents. So they continue to amaze. All right, well listen, thanks so much, Antonio, for being on the show. We're going to go now to the pad and look at the rocket for just a few moments. Later, Franklin and Mick will give us an update on what's going on. But as we switch out guests here to find out more about PACE, you can see that the rocket is out there on the pad. Not only did it roll out successfully, but it's gone vertical, and we are ready for launch early tomorrow morning. Of course, joining us now is Ulrich Gliese. Looking at this Phyto Fighter here, obviously pretty impressive representation of phytoplankton, at least according to Antonio. Would you say that the ocean color instrument, would it pick this up if this were floating in the ocean at any given time?
Yes, it would absolutely do that. It's designed to do that, right? So it would separate it out from the other plankton. So if you look at it, has some green colors here, and each of the different plankton species might have slightly different green colors, so they're very different to see with the existing instruments because they only look in a few bands.
Okay.
So OCI is looking at all the wavelengths in 5 nanometer resolution, and that enables us to see slight differences between those green colors, and then we can separate out the different species. So yes, we would absolutely pick this out among the others.
I'm amazed. I thought I would throw you with that question. But thinking of the complexity of OCI, It's interesting that you talk about this different spectrum that it can actually analyze. But it strikes me as interesting too, because it's all the way up in space, very high in the atmosphere, and yet it's looking almost microscopically into the ocean. How do you guys achieve that? It seems kind of like a miraculous thing that you're doing.
Yeah, the plankton are very tiny, but there's a lot of them, right? So they live in big plumes that breed up and down, you know, more and less of them. And so they're very visible from space because there's so many of them.
Now, how did you come up with this technology to actually do this? And how did you test it?
Yeah, so there was some work done before OCI started. OCI started about 9 years ago, so it's been a long time, so we're excited today.
That's right.
It's been almost a decade that we've been working on this. So there was an early study made, and it's based on previous technology to some extent, of course, and then some improvements. And they had demonstrated some of the ideas of how to do this. And then when the engineering team came in and started the design in earnest, we went through a lot of architecture studies first to find out what is the right way to do this. We started the technology and then we started the design. So you evolve it based on past technology and you make improvements based on the requirements that the scientists have.
And you're able to see through the clouds.
Yes, we are. And that's difficult, right? And so we have, for the plankton, we're measuring mostly in the like blue and green colors. And then we have a measurement up in near-infrared colors that help us correct for the atmosphere. We also have two polarimeters on the spacecraft, and they also help with that besides looking at the aerosols and particles.
Thanks so much for being on the show, Ulrich. We really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, it is very exciting to think about all the data we're going to get. But to get that data, we have to launch successfully. And so to get an update on the launch, we're going to go now to Mick and Franklin, who are actually in one of the control rooms here at Hangar AE. And they're here with an update. Franklin?
Thanks, Blair. I'm joined in one of the Hangar AE control rooms by Mick Waltman from NASA's Launch Services Program. Mick, can you give us an update on the Falcon 9 and the PACE satellite?
Yeah, the SpaceX team, the LSP team, and Space Force team have been working very hard over the early morning, getting the launch vehicle ready. They rolled to the pad late last night, went vertical about 4 a.m. this morning. Spacecraft team is now doing safe to mate and aliveness testing, basically verifying that their satellite is still good after transport, and continuing to process the vehicle, getting ready for a launch early this morning at 1:33 a.m.
Now, there is some weather in the area. Are there any conditions that would prevent us from having an on-time launch?
Yeah, the launch weather officer from the Space Force briefed us yesterday at our readiness review that there's about a 60% chance of violation. So we're going to be watching the weather today, basically that cloud rule and that upper-level wind.
What does an upper-level wind, how can that affect the trajectory of the rocket?
Yeah, so the rocket is designed to go through certain wind shears as it lifts off and ascends into space. And depending on that upper-level wind constraint, we want to make sure it's lower than the design of the rocket so we don't break the rocket or bend the rocket in a bad place. So the teams definitely will be assessing that and looking at that, and I think that's one of our concerns for today.
When we see a rocket leave the pad, a lot of people assume that it's going straight up to go into space. Yeah. But in fact, it kind of turns on its side. Can you tell us a little bit about what happens there?
Yeah, today's launch actually is very unique coming out of the Cape. We're going to lift off of Complex 40. We're going to be heading to a 98-degree inclination, so pretty much straight up. But the rocket then kind of follows the curvature of the Earth, or as we were say, parallel to the ground, right? But then as we head on a southeasterly trajectory, we're going to make a left dogleg and head over Cuba. And it's our first time doing a polar orbit from the Cape here in about 60 years for NASA. SpaceX has done this a couple times, and that is because of the new design of their vehicle, some upgrades they've done on their flight termination system, things they've worked with the Space Force in the range for personnel safety and vehicle safety. They're able to do this polar orbit out of here that we typically would do out of Vandenberg, out of California.
Now, Mick, you're going to be with Daryl Nail during the launch broadcast this evening. Do you have anything special in tune for us?
It's going to be a fun night. Like I said, I'm very excited about the PACE science mission and this single stick. This is our first mission for 2024 as LSP. We've got a couple more coming up. Our second Falcon Heavy with SpaceX, our GOES-U mission, and then later on this year, their Europa Clipper mission. So we want to focus on PACE today and get that done. So I'm excited about that and get this done early in the morning. So looking forward to that.
Definitely. We're looking forward to it as well. Mick, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Franklin.
We'll send it right back to Blair in our studio.
Thanks a lot, Franklin. And joining us now is Denton Gibson, who obviously you've kind of helped us in the past in the same role as Mick in giving us launch updates. Mm-hmm. But now you have a new role at LSP, Launch Services Program. Tell us about your new role.
Yes. Now I'm a launch director. Yeah. So that's a new role that I've stepped into and looking forward to execute for LSP in the future.
Tell me what's involved with being a launch director. What are some of the kind of things that you have to deal with in order to be a good launch director?
So, well, you know, first of all, being a launch director, you know, you have to be able to work with all the different teams. There's the launch vehicle team, the spacecraft team, and then also we have our government partners like Space Force and the range that we have to work with on a regular basis, and kind of managing that overall manifest. And, you know, it's not as simple as just going out and getting a launch date. There's a lot involved with it, a lot of coordination that's done, and there's a lot of information that we have to take into account to go for a launch attempt, because, you know, some of our missions have a very tight window that we'd have to get off, because if we don't, it could be years until we can actually launch again.
Right.
So we always have to take those things into consideration and give our missions the best chance to be successful.
How's the stress level?
You know, it's a good stress, right? You know, we tend to do our best work under pressure. Sure. And, you know, there's always things that come up last minute that we have to deal with, but we deal with it. And at the end of the day, seeing a successful launch and a successful mission is all worth it.
So you'd mentioned that you are actually backup on PACE.
Mm-hmm.
Is this like an understudy for a play? Like, do you have to, I mean, do you think that like Tim won't show up and you have to jump in? Or is that just a, tell me a little bit about what that means to be backup to a launch director.
So, you know, there's a lot of things that go on that can go on during a mission, during a countdown. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes one person can't keep up with everything that's happening. Mm-hmm. So as the backup, if Tim is off working some issue or he's paying attention to something, I will kind of cover for him in other areas where if his attention is all focused on a particular item.
When you applied for this process and you were trying to become a launch director, yeah, is that something you always wanted to do when you came to the launch services program?
You know, not at first, but, you know, after years of working on the launch vehicle side, you know, leading the engineering team, kind of focus on the launch vehicle, making sure that we get to launch successfully. And then for the last few years prior to becoming launch director, I was in a mission management program. So I got to work a lot with spacecraft and the customer. The ultimate position for me, once I had that spacecraft experience and that launch vehicle experience, was to be a launch director, kind of work with the full team and get to see the whole full picture of how we get from, you know, spacecraft concept all the way through to the launch operation. So
now I notice when Tim launches a rocket, he does a little click, click, click. Are you going to do something more dramatic, like a hammer drop or the elbow, or are you going to do something a little more so like a domino slap?
Well, you know, there's no button to click, right? Okay. But if there was, you know, where I grew up, we played a lot of dominoes. Yeah. So, you know, I may have to come with a domino slam, but, you know, but I also am a fan of wrestling, so I might have to come in with the elbow.
There you go. Off the third turnbuckle.
Yep.
All right, thanks so much, Denton, for being on the show, and good luck on URT 10. Good luck on GOJU. Sorry about that.
Appreciate
mixing
it.
My missions. Whew. That was a tough one, Franklin. There was so much information on phytoplankton, it caused an algae bloom of delirium. I couldn't keep track.
You weren't the only one, Blair. PACE also had issues, including weather, like Mick mentioned in our update, that ultimately led to several scrubbed launch attempts.
But luckily, we eventually got to see a successful launch early in the morning on a SpaceX Falcon 9. Watch out, Plankton. We're coming for you.
You can run, but you can't hide.
You're watching NASA Edge.
An inside and outside look at all things NASA.